Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, it was a week ago today that the Cook family informed state officials that they were pulling out of their agreement to reopen the old Kentucky Kingdom Amusement Park as Bluegrass Boardwalk. That disclosure came just a few days after the company was approved for state incentives to bring the park back to life. It's been shuttered now for more than 2 years after its previous operator, Six Flags, sought bankruptcy protection. You might remember the Cook family signed a lease to reopen the park after the State Fair Board, which owns the property, cut off talks with developer Ed Hart. He had previously run the park during its Kentucky Kingdom incarnation and had put forth a proposal to get it up and running again. And joining us to talk about all this is developer Ed Hart. Mr. Hart, welcome to the program.
Rick, it's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. And also here is WFPL's Devin Katayama, who's been covering the recent turn of events. And we'll start with you, Devin, for a bit of a review. Mm-hmm. What reason did the Cook family give for pulling out of the lease?
Well, essentially, and they own Holiday World in Indiana as well, they said that their family business model does not really match well with so much government oversight, and not necessarily any specific government oversight, but just the need for them to make the quick decisions that they say they generally make at their Holiday World. They're just not able to do that. And I spoke with Natalie Cook on Saturday. They were taking some media interviews, and this is what she had to say about that.
Following their rules and regulations that they have to use. And I understand that. But the longer the process went on, the more we realized it was outside of our model, because sometimes we need to make snap decisions, and that just wasn't going to be possible working with the government. And we certainly appreciate everything that the government did for us. We were very impressed with the Fair Board and the mayor's office. But in the end, you know, we like to control a few more things, and it was apparent that we were not going to be able to make snap decisions or do things the way that we do them here at Holiday World.
And this was 2 days after they went through the process of being approved for the tax incentives at $3.9 million over 10 years. And that process actually took them a while. They were delayed in some of that process along the way. So I guess the question I had all along was, what snap decisions at this point do they need to be making? You know, they've been to the difficult part of getting the tax incentives.
Well, Mr. Hart, let's bring you in here. Now, you have contended, and not necessarily as a criticism, this is not a knock, but excuse me, that the Cook family got into this as a business strategy to protect their Indiana operation.
Well, I think, Rick, truth is an absolute defense here. The fact remains that the only winner in this Holiday World debacle has been Holiday World. And let me explain what I mean by that. Every year the park, Kentucky Kingdom, doesn't reopen, that's tantamount to hundreds of thousands of persons going to Holiday World that would not otherwise go to Kentucky Kingdom. Considering that that's all plus business for Holiday World, and by their own press statements, they said after the initial season when Kentucky Kingdom was closed that they picked up a couple of hundred thousand visitors because of the closing of Kentucky Kingdom, then the only person that's going to gain by the continued closing of Kentucky Kingdom is Holiday World, to the tune of millions of dollars that would otherwise be spent in Kentucky. Now, listen, the last thing I want to do, and I don't want to get into an argument with Natalie Cook. You know, they run a very, very nice facility up there. They're business people. But it does beg the question that you left Harold Workman and the Fair Board at the altar. I mean, after all, you had the wedding dress, that's the lease. You had the ring, and that is that's the tax credits they got. To say at the end of that nine-month process that we really don't want to rent, we want to own, as though you didn't realize you were renting from the beginning. And also, if you say it's difficult to deal with the government, that's called a lease. You work those difficulties out in the lease. Mm-hmm. That's what a lease is for. We had no problem working with the government when I operated Kentucky Kingdom in the 90s, as long as the lease terms provided efficient and smooth operations. So, frankly, if they're the only winners in the process, yes, I'm a bit suspicious of some of their excuses. But this is not about the Cook family in my mind. My grudge all along was I wanted to see The park that we originally built is the number one tourist attraction in Kentucky. I wanted to see that park remain intact as a regional theme park. That's where you get the tremendous economic benefits. That's where you get $10 million of plus new revenue for the state per the state's own study. And that's where we put 1,000 young people to work and we put 50 to 100 well-paying full-time jobs to work. My goal was to keep it as a regional theme park. To that extent, I'm really excited because this is not about Ed Hart. This is about making sure Kentucky Kingdom is a regional theme park. I'm really excited that Harold Workman says he has found some regional theme park operators to come in and open Kentucky Kingdom as a regional theme park. I totally applaud that effort and that initiative. My gripe with the Cooks was they were going to turn it into a small local water park and hope, if they were successful, whatever that word means, to then reinvest in the facility. Based upon the sort of business that a water park throws off in terms of profitability, they wouldn't have enough money to make the major investments in those big rides. So I don't mean to be so windy, but the reality is, yes, I am not surprised at all they pulled out. I expected it to happen all along, but I am really pleased and excited that Mr. Workman has identified some regional theme park operators.
Now, you spent 18 months negotiating with the Fair Board yourself to reopen the park, and it seems like the talks got cut off rather abruptly. What happened?
Well, you know, Rick, that's a great question, and I can't answer. I mean, I don't understand why they stopped our conversations. First of all, not only did we have proven turnaround experience, but we had $29 million ready to go. Plus, we had a strategic partner in the Al J. Schneider Company. Let's face it, one of the best hospitality companies in our community. And finally, we were homegrown operators. I mean, you don't want to have absentee owners like the Six Flags Kentucky Kingdom people. When I owned the park, and if Mary was involved, Mary Mosley, who's the president of Al J. Schneider, if we're involved, as we hope to be then, you can't walk down the street without somebody stopping you and saying what their problems might be, what they liked, what they didn't like. That homegrown component is really, really important because you have the heart, you know, the heartbeat of our community. So I think we had all the pieces, and the $29 million was double what the Holiday World folk were going to put in. We had what we thought was a very, very fair and equitable lease, and then all of a sudden, it stopped. We made several proposals after that, and the Fair Board never responded to those proposals. We just received a letter saying that they were no longer interested. So it's a puzzle to me what happened. I wish I could answer the question. I can't.
What did some of those proposals look like? What did they add that might not have been there before?
Yeah, well we were trying to work our way through some of the lease issues and Devin, I could get into the weeds and I could bore your audience by the myriad of deal points. But I believe Harold Workman, I really believe we could have worked our way through those deal points if given an opportunity. But the Fair Board decided they were going to terminate our negotiations. I think we could have got through all of those.
Now, actually, when I spoke with Natalie, she was saying that Mr. Workman's departure is also a sort of a reason why they decided to pull out. Do you buy that?
It's a 50-year lease. The Holiday World had a 50-year lease. Remember, they had a lease. The Fair Board approved their lease. They never approved our lease. We never even got the tourism department to accept our application. They got approval on tourism tax credits. They got the two things that we never got. To say that they were concerned about whether Mr. Workman would be in his position or that the governor would be in his position, it really begs credibility. It's a 50-year lease with two 25-year options. Effectively, you have a 100-year lease. Do you really think anybody's going to know who's going to be our governors for the next 100 years? Or I know Harold's a very clever and intelligent guy. I just don't think he's going to live for another 100 years.
Are there any circumstances under which you would get back into the negotiations and get involved in reopening the park?
Rick, you know, that's really a question you have to ask the Fair Board. Nobody's called us. It's been a week. Nobody's called us to let's pick up the negotiations where we left off. If somebody called, of course, we'd answer that phone call, and we might very well sit down, but that hasn't happened. It's been a week, and frankly, I don't think it will happen.
Harold Workman has said, as you mentioned, that there are some companies interested in reopening the park. He wouldn't be specific about that. I assume there are some good regional companies out there that could do the job.
Well, if it's one of the majors, I mean, if Harold's talking about a national theme park operator, we get Disney in here, or Universal, or Busch Gardens people, or there's a whole string of top tier operators. The Hershen Company, they operate Silver Dollar City and Dollywood. If any of those companies are interested, or Harold's talking to, I think that's super exciting. Now, of course, there's a whole bunch of bottom fishers, people that are not capable to come in with the cash, but they may make a call and show an inquiry. So, like everyone else, I'm anxious to know who he's talking to, because I applaud his initiative.
From your perspective, is there a strong market here for an amusement park the size of Kentucky Kingdom?
Devin, when I first embarked upon this 20 years ago, I guess it's a little bit more than 20 years, in 1990, the media reports at that time was I had to be crazy to try to build a theme park in the shadow of Kings Island. We went from 137,000 visitors in our first year in 1990 to over 1.3 million people by the time we got to selling it to Six Flags. So, of course, there's a market. Now, if Kentucky Kingdom reopens, I think Holiday World will do fine, but it simply won't do the attendance it's currently doing. And Kentucky Kingdom will do if it has the right assortment of attractions. Remember, big rides equals attendance and attractions. As long as it has the firepower of constant reinvestment in new rides and attractions, there's no question it's a million-plus facility. And again, what puzzles me is that the state understands at a time of budget crises, that adds $10 million plus in revenue, tax revenue, that they're losing when Kentuckians leave the state to visit theme parks, Holiday World or Kings Island or wherever, and when we don't draw the people in from Indianapolis and Nashville. Their own report indicated there were a couple hundred thousand overnight stays because of Kentucky Kingdom. I mean, add it up. Why would you not want to get this thing open sooner than later? Had they made the deal with us, we would be opened now. Now, every year it's delayed, it costs the state up to $10 million a year. So it's baffling, Devin, from an economic point of view and from a job point of view, why our political leaders haven't made this a top priority. Now, I feel glad that the mayor apparently is now reengaged. That's exciting, and he's going to throw his influence into the ring. I hope the governor's office reengages. I hope the local Louisville delegation and its leadership reengages. This is important for the community. And why wouldn't we want to reopen Kentucky Kingdom sooner than later? Enough of the words. Let's get to the deeds.
And I have to let that be the last word. Ed Hart, thanks for joining us. Devin Katayama as well, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with more in a moment. You are listening to Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hellett. Well, last year, state officials approved a plan to bring on more managed care operators, MCOs, regional companies to administer Kentucky's Medicaid program, which has been facing huge budget shortfalls. Well, the sailing has not always been smooth. At least one MCO wants to renegotiate its contract with the state, claiming it was not given accurate information. Healthcare providers say they're not being treated fairly by some of the MCOs. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston has been covering the latest developments involving the MCO Coventry and also Passport, which I'll talk about in a minute, which covers the Louisville area. Kenny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Coventry, which has gone to court to break its contract. And correct me if I'm wrong, Coventry serves like the eastern portion of the state?
Coventry actually serves statewide. It is Kentucky's largest private Medicaid operator. But they have, they are also, because of that, they are the biggest provider in eastern, you know, the southeastern and northeastern, where a lot of your Medicaid patients are. And so they have a lot of what you would call the high risk patients, the people that are chronically ill, that constantly go to the doctor or to the ER. So they are the biggest out there, but also biggest statewide.
So Coventry has gone to court to break its contract, and there was a hearing on that this week?
That's right, and the judge finally ruled this week after a few weeks of a court battle. And basically, the rule, I wouldn't say the ruling was favorable to Coventry at all. The judge ruled that they have to keep their contract with Appalachian Regional Healthcare, which is the big health hospital network out in eastern Kentucky. And they have to do it at the same rates. Coventry was looking to either break that contract to go elsewhere to reduce their cost, or reduce their cost in a contract with with ARH. And neither happened. The federal judge said that they have to keep the current thing so that there's actually patient care in the area, which is what ARH was basically arguing for, is that without us, you can't have adequate coverage, which is a key tenet of the contract with the state.
So is managed care saving money as it wasn't intended to?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Coventry has lost $50 million in the first quarter alone. That's basically why they said, we're going around to these hospitals and these doctors and we're asking them to take less money, or we're breaking contracts, because as a business, I mean, they're a publicly traded business. They have stockholders, oddly enough. Some of the stock that is being held or that is out there is owned by Kentucky's pension systems, which are woefully underfunded. So the fact that Coventry is doing bad actually hurts the state in multiple ways, because they want to break contracts. But second of all, the pension systems lose money, because $50 million loss, obviously your stock's going to go down. But in terms of the state, I mean, Governor Beshear said that it was supposed to save $1 billion. And oddly enough, in the first quarter, statewide MCA, the state saved $50 million. I don't know if there's a direct connection there or not, but at least the dollar figures add up. And, you know, the cabinet secretary, Audrey Haynes, says that they are on track to save probably more than the $1 billion that was estimated. And that's what managed care is all about. It's about saving money. It's about reducing doctor visits. It's about reducing costs. And when you look at it in that sense, it looks like it's successful. What people are arguing about is that there's not as much care. There's not as much adequate care. People aren't getting the treatment or the medicines they need. So basically, that's where all the problems have resided, is that people aren't getting the care they need, but, you know, money is being saved.
How common is this practice in other states?
You know, this is growing. A lot of other states have looked at this or gone to this. Missouri has gone to this. Kansas is starting to look at this. You know, some of these groups, Coventry, WellCare, Centene, who owns Kentucky Spirit, you know, they are national businesses. This is why they can be publicly traded, because they operate in multiple states with this MCO. Other states have gone out of it. Ohio has flip-flopped between letting companies come in and run the whole show to the state taking more control. I believe Connecticut is looking at scrapping their MCO program completely. So basically, it just depends on your state, and that's the argument here. With a lot of unhealthy people out in eastern Kentucky and an unhealthy state as a whole, will MCOs, will managed care work here?
Now, there has been a success story here in Kentucky, correct, with a Passport, which has been covering the Louisville area for a number of years.
That's right. It's Region 3, which is mainly the Louisville area and 16 counties surrounding it.
Next.
So what is basically happening is that Passport has been successful for 15 years, but what's going on is Passport is no longer going to have their exclusivity. And, you know, to note, Passport had a lot of problems to begin with as well. It took them quite a few years to get going, a lot of lawmaker influence to get going. And there was also an MCO in Lexington that ended up failing that started around the same time as Passport. But what's happening is like, we have three statewide MCOs. The Passport region, Region 3, is being opened up to competition. And the state basically opened up the what's called an RFP, a request for proposal, mm-hmm. sent those out this week. We don't know exactly who they've been sent out to, but we do know that there is a lot of interest from both local companies and national companies to get in this region, because the Louisville region has a lot of hospitals, a lot of doctors. You can save and make a lot of money in this region.
Now, has it always been opened up for competition, or is this a new thing?
No, that's new. Basically, the federal government said earlier this year that Passport is losing its exclusivity contract. There's a lot of internal politics, a lot of inside baseball, a lot of drama about that. A lot of people are saying the former cabinet secretary, Janie Miller, and this was brought up in a committee meeting this week, might have had a vendetta or had some kind of grudge against people at Passport, and basically just didn't tell the federal government to renew the exclusivity. So they did what they do elsewhere, and they said that there needs to be competition. That's why there's proposals being sent out this week. That's why at least two companies will manage Medicaid in the Louisville region in the future. Passport is going to bid on that contract for one of those contracts. But what's going to be interesting to see, they're very well known for a high quality of care, but high quality of care means expensive care. And MCOs aren't, you know, like we've talked about, MCOs are not good with expensive care.
So the likelihood is now that the Louisville region, Region 3, I think you called it, will be split up between Passport and still an unnamed company.
Right. We know at least one company we've talked about at United Healthcare has tried to get in. They've kind of already sent letters out. There's a lot of interest between the statewide MCOs. So that's what we're looking at. You know, WellCare, Coventry, and Kentucky Spirit clearly operate statewide. You would have to think that they're at least taking a look about looking in the Louisville region, because obviously that's the best and the most popular region. But outside of that, you know, there's no telling. Could someone like a Humana get into it? Maybe. Could someone like Amerigroup, which is a national company? Maybe. We'll just have to wait and see. They have until the end of July to turn in their bids.
All right, we'll be keeping an eye on it. Kenny Colston from Kentucky Public Radio, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
We're going to turn our attention now to the Louisville City budget, the Metro budget. The Louisville Metro Council last night approved the $500 million plus spending plan for the next fiscal year that starts July 1st. Of course, it's subject to the signature of Mayor Greg Fisher. And joining us to tell us what's in it and how it differs from the plan proposed by the mayor earlier this year, a couple of months ago, is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, welcome back.
Hey, Rick. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. And so the budget has been approved by the Metro Council. Any chance that the mayor is going to be going in and, first of all, does he have line item veto power? And if so, what changes might he make?
Yes, the mayor actually does have that authority to line item and go in specific areas. The mayor sent out a statement last night thanking the Metro Council for reviewing the budget and for looking it over, and he'll look it over in the next couple of days. It's a $514 million budget. The council added about $2 million. 1.5 of that came from undesignated projects that the council put over, and about $300,000, $500,000 from park. Basically, the council saying that the mayor needs to renegotiate that deal with the Parking Authority of River City to sell those parking garages. So that is sort of the changes that you saw initially. But last night's debate really centered around this contentious argument about the Whiskey Row development.
And this is an appropriation of, what, about $500,000?
Yes, to give developers an additional $500,000 that will go into this sort of revolving loan idea. So that is pretty much what the city had already done, is give the developers about $1.5 million in a forgivable loan. So there were many council members who had voiced some serious objections to that, a bipartisan group of council members. In fact, Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh ended up introducing an amendment to strike that language out of the ordinance so that the city wouldn't have to be repaid $1 million if the project makes a profit. But you saw some people, not just on the council, address that, but you saw some speakers, including River City Drum Corps founder and CEO Ed White, whose arts group has been cut in the budget. And he had some complaints to share as well.
The River City Drum Corps, in 10 years, has sent 35 children to college, and of those 35, 15 are still going, 10 have graduated. But what I'm saying to you is, it's important, because since 2007, Louisville has had 256 murders. Of those 256 murders, 75 of them were children that had been through our program and other programs that had to go back to the streets because the doors were closed. And it's amazing when I see those children, when we turn them out on the streets with their lights on, and then to go and see them with their lights out. And so therefore, it's very, very important. And normally people ask me, have you seen what's in the budget for you? I say, well, you know, I'm tired of looking. Whatever they give me is what they give me. I will continue to do the work. But why? Why? You know, when we think about, we can sit here and give some investors $1.5 million to renovate seven buildings that one rich guy said, I don't want, they're not worth anything, we're going to tear them down. And so another group comes and, you know, oh, they look pretty, but what good do they do? And then you give them $1.5 million unforgivable grant, and then they get the building and come back and say, oh, it's going to cost a little bit more money than we thought. And then we come back to the city, and the city gives them another $500,000. Just think. if you could take that $500,000 and give it to the people who are actually in the trenches doing the work.
So this is quite contentious. We got an email earlier. We were talking to Ed Hart about Kentucky Kingdom, and somebody suggested to why not declare it a historic area and city appropriation.
Well, and some council members, I mean, brought that up, saying that, you know, their objections were that this $500,000 could be spent better elsewhere. Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, for example, said at last night's meeting that she could take that $500,000 and rehab just about every vacant home in District 3. Other council members were just questioning, shouldn't these funds go elsewhere? Why give that on top of the $1.5 million forgivable loan? And as I mentioned earlier, the Budget Committee unanimously approved language in the ordinance that required developers to reimburse the city $1 million of that $1.5 if the Whiskey Row buildings were later sold. So what the Fisher administration argued was that that tied their hands, that you have council sort of in this unprecedented level getting involved in the deal. So you saw CFO Steve Rowland and some of the other of the mayor's representatives pressuring the council, lobbying the council to create that amendment to take that language out of there. So last night was really this contest between whether it was important to fund Whiskey Row, which people remember. Listen, preservationists fought really hard, people remember, a few years ago, to get these buildings preserved, get them out of Todd Blue's hands, and this group of developers to come along and help. The cost of that, however, has tripled since the original deal was struck. Initially, people thought it was going to be about $2 million. Now it'll be about $7 million to fix those buildings. Councilman Jerry Miller, who was in favor of this language and was critical of the deal, the additional $500,000, he made the point that, you know, listen, these are investors who are well connected to the mayor. Some of them are the mayor's friends. They made a risky investment. Oops, that's not our fault. And Councilman Kelly Downer, who's the vice chair of the Budget Committee, made the point this is a bailout in his view. So it got pretty contentious last night, to the point where, as a result of this, five Metro Council members voted against the capital projects portion of the budget. But after that, really, it was pretty much smooth sailing from there. The mayor will, like I said earlier, will review this and look at it, and he'll make the decision there. But it's unlikely that any vetoes will happen as a result. The mayor pretty much got what he wanted.
Now, as it stands now, there is a reduction in funding to a university hospital for indigent care that would have raised some concerns. It was previously $9 million, and it's now down to $7 million.
Right? And the council didn't add any funds to that, which came to a bit of a surprise, considering that some council members were very critical of the cut. And obviously, members of the media as well were critical of the mayor for this. University Hospital argued in front of the council when they had their hearing that, listen, this is going to result in poor patients, indigent care being cut in our facilities. That's certainly a problem for many members on the Metro Council, but there was no additional funds put in there. Now, the clause in the budget says if revenue projections are ahead at all, if there are some additional funds that are done or through revenue projections put into the budget, those additional funds will go into the indigent care fund for University Hospital. So that's some good news on that front. But that all depends upon, Rick, as you know, the economy. Mm-hmm. So if the economy is doing better over the next fiscal year, University Hospital will see some additional funds. But still, to have those funds cut, I think, has left many people sort of taken aback, especially once again, people brought up that with the Whiskey Road development, saying, you know, why take $500,000 to give to these buildings that we don't know if they'll be rehabilitated? That $500,000 could have been spent on indigent care or additional funding for vacant properties or additional funding here or there. Councilwoman Ward Pugh, I think, made an excellent point saying that she felt that this was people trying to pit one group against the other. You can't pit vacant properties against, you know, Whiskey Row. You can't pit indigent care against Whiskey Row.
And this appropriation, this reduction, also affects the state appropriation, right?
Yes, as earlier, and as Kenny's reported, has pointed out, the General Assembly made it clear that, you know, we're only going to match what the city matches. And that's why some people say, you know, technically this is a cut. The mayor's office argues that we're not cutting the funding. It was always $7 million. We just gave University Hospital 9.7. They gave us back 2.7 in a rebate. But as a result of this, the state is also going to cut their funding. So for University Hospital, this is sort of a cut from both ends. Now, the mayor has raised some important questions, I believe, in different editorials. He's made the mention that, you know, why is the city of Louisville the only city that's given into indigent care funding like this? What about the oversight of the University of Louisville or University Hospital itself? And also there's this question of how will the Affordable Care Act impact us, considering that we're all waiting on the U.S. Supreme Court to make its decision on the president's health care law. That could impact this to a degree. So there's still some things that are left unanswered. But at this point, I think many people who are in favor of the Energy Care Fund and who are supporters of University Hospital are concerned and a bit taken aback by the cut.
WFPL's Philip M. Bailey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Keeping us apprised of the city budget. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. The Veterans Administration is now on the verge of purchasing over 35 acres of property on Brownsboro Road to build a new VA hospital here in Louisville. And officials say that decision could be made in the coming weeks. Consultants have concluded that building the hospital at that site would not have a significant impact on traffic or quality of life in the area, and that was reported this week by Chris Otts of the Courier-Journal and WFPL's Devin Kadiyama, and both are here in the studio with me. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
Hey, Rick.
Well, let's talk about the decision or this consultant's report that says the hospital at that site would not have a significant impact on traffic. Chris, what's been the local reaction from folks who live in the area to this?
Well, obviously, a lot of folks who live in the area disagree. The number one complaint that I've heard is just that the operation that they are trying to put onto that site is just too big for the site, and that they'd have much more room at another location. People are worried about traffic and access issues. But the VA said that they needed 25 acres of developable land, and the site is certainly that. It's, you know, the VA tends to say it's 36 acres. The developer at one point says 38 acres, but you know, it's nearly 40 acres. So it's certainly big enough in terms of what the VA said that it was looking for when it put out a request for developable greenfield sites.
And the Factory Lane site, the second site, is, I believe, 99 acres.
Yes, it's huge.
In eastern Jefferson County, yeah.
Yes, yeah, site. It's huge. It's out off of Old Henry Road, beyond the Snyder, and kind of where there's some new outpatient healthcare facilities going up around there. But it's mostly undeveloped.
So what kind of traffic modifications will need to be made for this to go forward, Devin?
Well, they've been talking about building a new eastbound off-ramp from the Waterson to Brownsboro Road directly. That's really the biggest change that would have to happen. And they're actually starting to do some new developments, I believe, next week.
They're starting this week. There's a contract that the state government has let with, a firm from Clarksville, Indiana. They're building that new slip ramp that you were talking about that will go kind of directly off of the Waterson onto Brownsboro Road, which changes its name around there so many times that it's confusing to talk about. But basically, you'll go right by that Dairy Queen and you'll kind of bypass that dog leg thing that people have to do now when they get off that way. There are some other improvements there. They're widening that little stretch by the Dairy Queen. They're adding a left turn lane from that off ramp. But ultimately, the long-term solution, the state has said, is to rebuild the entire interchange at US 42 and the Waterson Expressway.
So what are we looking at in terms of a timeline? What timeline? What happens next?
Well, the VA says that they will make a decision as to the Brownsboro Road site or the Factory Lane site. Brownsboro Road is still preferred, but they haven't made the final decision yet. And that should take another couple weeks, they said. And once they do, they are free to go ahead and purchase the land. They have the funding for that. The funding for the construction has not been appropriated yet in Congress, and we don't know how much money is going to be needed for that. Congressman Yarmouth's office says that the construction money shouldn't be a problem. And the VA's timeline is to complete the hospital by the end of 2017 and have it open early 2018.
What have veterans who are going to be using the hospital had to say about this location? Is there unanimous support for this, or is it kind of split?
Well, the research the VA did indicated that, by and large, they all supported staying at the Zorn Avenue location, yeah, which the VA ruled out. So, you know, beyond that, some veterans just want to see this thing, you know, get done wherever it is and be over with. Some of the younger veterans may prefer downtown. I had a story about that a few weeks ago. But for the most part, veterans just want the thing built. And they were strongly against going downtown in the aggregate numbers that the VA survey produced back in 2009.
What other sites were being considered?
Well, there's the Factory Lane site, as we talked about. There was a site off Fagenbush Lane that's been ruled out. They were considering rebuilding the hospital at Zorn Avenue. They've ruled that out. And they were also considering a site very close to University Hospital and the U of L School of Medicine downtown. And they've ruled that out as well.
So I know some veterans had argued on rebuilding at the Zorn location. So obviously this looks like this Brownsboro Road location is going to be the place where it's going to be.
Sure.
When might this be finished?
The construction you're talking about?
Yes, the whole hospital.
By the end of about 2017 or early 2018, I talked with a VA official earlier this week, and she said by the end of 2017 it should be done.
So what, I guess my question would be, what needs to happen between now and then? Some of this additional funding has to be
secured
for it. Yes,
Congress has to appropriate money for it. And like I said, Congressman Yarmouth's office says that he doesn't anticipate that that will be a problem. But that money does need to be appropriate. They've got about $75 million that's already been committed just for the planning, the land acquisition, and that kind of stuff. They haven't given an estimate of how much money is needed to build this hospital, but it should be several hundred million dollars.
And again, the decision should be made in the next few weeks. The final step was getting that public comment period and then finalizing the contract from the Ohio consulting firm. I believe they're from Ohio.
Yes.
And when I was speaking with Bob Morey, who's project manager for VA, he thought this process was going to be moving forward pretty quickly.
Okay, we're going to have to cut it off there because we are out of time. Chris Ottz from the Courier-Journal, WFPL's Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us. We'll be back with more in a moment. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Helwitt. Well, this is the portion of the program that we dedicate to the arts and humanities, and WFPL's Aaron Keene is here with a special guest. Aaron?
Thanks, Rick. I'm here with Barbara Sexton-Smith, who is the president and CEO of the Fund for the Arts. The Fund for the Arts is wrapping up its campaign this year, and so Barbara's on to talk with us a little bit about the evolution of the Fund for the Arts, funding priorities, and just where does the money go, and who are you giving to? Hi, Barbara.
Hey, Erin. Thanks for having me this afternoon.
Well, thanks for coming aboard. I think a lot of folks have seen the Fund for the Arts campaigns at their workplace, for example. But if you could just give us a brief overview of what is the Fund for the Arts? What are people giving to when they sign those pledge cards at work?
Well, the Fund for the Arts is an umbrella fundraising organization in support of the arts with a focus on economic development, education, and creating a better quality of life for all of our citizens. That was Mayor Farnsley's dream in 1949, and we have stayed true to that dream to this very day. So it's a great question when you ask about the workplace giving campaign, because in our region, we have more than 22,000 people that contribute to the Fund for the Arts. And it's really amazing. And 46% of all the money that we raise, which we're hoping to announce more than $8 million here in a couple of weeks for this last campaign, but more than 46% of that comes from folks in the workplace signing a pledge card.
Wow. And so how much longer in this year's campaign?
Well, actually, we wrap up on June 30th, and I just left the office and saw a report that says we need to raise $52,000 a day between now and June 30th if we want to hit $8 million. And I think we're going to do it because we just got the results in from the Metro Louisville employees, Mayor Greg Fisher's folks. So we've been campaigning with the police officers and firefighters and the Solid Waste Management Services, and then I went several weeks ago to the midnight shift at the jail. Several of the officers there have children who have been in the Louisville Youth Orchestra or the Stage One plays. They've been to visit those, and so folks are signing up. But really what's fun, Aaron, is we campaign all across the region, and we've spent the last 8 days over at Jeff Boat with an ACL. So Teamsters 89 really came through for us at Jeff Boat. More than 57% of the folks that are over there building the barges in this 90-degree weather. I was told it's 120 degrees in the belly of the barge today. They come up out of those barges and hear our art story. And more than 57% gave a gift, and they've given more than $61,000 to the Fund for the Arts.
Wow. So what is the most compelling fundraising hook that you've found? What is it that sells the Fund for the Arts donation to the Teamster, to the receptionist at, you know, in a city organization? What's the big sell?
Well, hands down, folks at that level are giving, I believe, because of the impact it makes on our education system. Mm-hmm. You know, the Fund for the Arts is about creating a college-going culture, and we have to start in kindergarten when we do that. So we tell stories about how we have a dream that there'll come a day when every child in our region enters the kindergarten level all the way through 12th grade will have a different art experience every year. So, for example, last year, thanks to a generous gift from the Horseshoe Foundation of Floyd County, the Stage One Family Theater was able to provide live play experiences for every child, kindergarten through sixth grade. So we really appreciate that. And then third graders over in Jefferson County Public School Systems get to learn about conflict resolution and anger management when the Kentucky Shakespeare folks go into the classrooms using Romeo and Juliet. And so can't forget Kentucky Shakespeare. They're getting ready to open up on July 12th. If I can give them a little plug here, I want everybody to join me on July 12th, Thursday night, opening night of Kentucky Shakespeare in Central Park. We're going to have our campaign announcement,
so you'll have to be there that night
for that and see Much Ado About Nothing.
Well, and that, you know, there's research that new research from the NEA that just came out that drew such a strong relationship between student achievement and involvement in the arts, not just exposure, but real involvement, especially among lower socioeconomic students, but across the board as well. And the thing that really that surprised me the most, pleasantly surprised me, was not just student achievement as in creating a college-bound culture, as you said, but also creating kids who are more likely to volunteer in their community if they have arts involvement, are more likely to vote and be involved in a political campaign, too. So these arts experiences, I think, you know, they have this ripple effect that goes beyond good grades at college or beyond sort of an enrichment experience as we think of it.
Right. That's a wonderful study that was conducted by Dr. James Catterall from Southern California. And it's a 12-year study where he took 25,000 students at age 12 and has tracked them all the way to where now they're 25 years of age and older, and there are more than 16,000 people still in this study. Very interesting fact that came out of that was not just about the students' level of engagement and how well they do in school and then how well they perform once they find their first job out of college and their voting records and so forth. What we found out was that the teachers and administrators in an arts rich school are more likely to want to stay after school and help the children or get involved in extracurricular activities. So what they did is they studied the rate at which teachers and administrators were wanting to get to the parking lot when the afternoon bell rang. I'm not kidding. And they discovered that there was not this mass exodus to the parking lot if it was an arts-rich school. And an arts-rich school is a school that brings arts programming in. And so, for example, here in our region, we've heard lots of stories in the last few years about cut in arts and the music teacher's gone or the art teacher's gone and so forth. And yes, that is the case in some places. But because you have a fund for the arts in this region, we are so lucky because the monies that we are able to generate, much of that goes to the school systems, to the several school systems in the region, so they can bring in folks from Actors Theater, Louisville Orchestra, Kentucky Opera, Stage One Family Theater, Louisville Visual Art Association, Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft. And these folks, among others, can provide folks in the classroom. So, for example, Walden Theater may go in and teach eco-drama, as they have been doing at a school in West Louisville, using drama to teach science. We've had students be taught history by using drama. Can you imagine what it would have been like when you learned your history lessons if you were able to play a role and act out in a play versus just reading the story or the chapter in the history book and listening to the teacher lecture about it? It just really makes it a much greater experience for the child.
Dibs on Aaron Burr.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about who's giving money here locally and how that how Louisville's donor base stacks up to the national level. Is Louisville, are we giving as much as other communities of our size? How are we doing?
Well, we're a very generous community. The current national statistics say that United Art Funds across America, and there are 58 cities that have a United Art Fund similar to ours, the per capita giving average is $2.34. But here in our region, our United Art Fund per capita in 2011 was $6.13. Hmm. Another interesting statistic to compare ourselves nationally is that if you look at the United Art Fund cities across the nation, you will find that 40% of the money they generate in any given year comes from individuals. In our region, 64% of our aggregate campaign revenues come from individuals.
Oh, so not from necessarily from the workplace campaigns then.
No, that does include the workplace campaign, because an individual donor is a person who is giving individually out of their own bank account or paycheck.
So whether as opposed to foundations.
As opposed to corporation or foundation or government funding. So I think it's interesting to look at the entire revenue pie, if you will. Mayor Fisher likes to talk about making the pie bigger. Well, I call that distributive and versus integrative fundraising. So, yes, we've made the pie bigger. And what I mean by that is we have a handful of major corporations that generate contribute very generously to the Fund for the Arts. Nationally speaking, since 2004, there has not been an increase in corporate contributions to the arts and culture sector. This last year, we did see a national increase of 1.4%. Locally, we are seeing a slight uptick as well, thanks to folks like Humana and Brown-Forman and Yum, Fifth Third Bank, and many others that step up to the plate. Republic Bank this last year. Aaron, you know about this Power to Give program that we launched. Thanks to Republic Bank's very generous gift of matching funds, we were able to now lead the nation in the amount of funds that we are raising on our new web-based platform.
So Power to Give is sort of like Kickstarter for the region's arts organizations. We're one of only a handful of, and I think just the second community, I believe, to come on board with the Power to Give program.
Well, Power to Give was a brainchild of the Fund for the Arts here in Louisville, Kentucky, and the Fund for the Arts and Arts Council in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then the folks in Charlotte, North Carolina, you may remember Scott Prevancher used to be here, and he was executive director of the Louisville Orchestra. Scott and his team developed this software to have a web-based platform that is project-based funding for arts and culture. They tested that in Charlotte last summer. They launched August and did a test market. But last December, our region, the Fund for the Arts, launched as the first major host city. And we launched all across the Commonwealth of Kentucky, including Southern Indiana. And any 501c3 nonprofit organization in Kentucky or Southern Indiana can post a project on Power to Give and then promote donations to their specific project via social media. So that's the beauty of this program. Once you go on, Aaron, and I hope you will, and you give $10 or so using your credit card to your favorite project, it'll ask you if you want to communicate that through Facebook or Twitter or email, and you will do that. So since we launched December 5th, we have generated more than $427,000 for nonprofits throughout Kentucky and Southern Indiana, and more than 63 organizations have benefited from this. And I think what's really interesting, there have been more than 1,400 donations made on this site.
Wow. And so this is Power to Give allows smaller organizations a chance to get in there and use the power of the Fund for the Arts and this electronic platform in order to raise money for some smaller projects maybe that they that might not necessarily compete with the top big powerhouse cultural partners that you have. But, you know, one thing that folks have wondered about over the past few years is funding priorities. What makes an arts organization eligible for a big part of that pie versus a small part that they might raise themselves?
Well, what we've been doing during this last year, the Fund for the Arts was asked by the community to be relevant and innovative and evolutionary. And an area that we were asked to take a critical evaluation of was our allocations process. So we've been coming through that. And going forward, the Fund for the Arts Board of Directors is very interested in funding mission-consistent initiatives and will be focused on measurable outcomes. So they're going to be looking for things like community impact,
Okay.
That will become very important. We'll be looking for the creation of vibrant neighborhoods. Corporations, when they give money to the Fund for the Arts, they're interested in measurable outcomes. When the government gives money to the Fund for the Arts, they're interested in, are we creating jobs? And we are.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being with us here today, Barbara.
All right. Thank you.
Barbara Sexton Smith, the president and CEO of the Fund for the Arts, speaking with WFPL's Aaron Keene. Thank you both for being here. That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News Team, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, Philip M. Bailey, and Aaron Keene. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For information about topics discussed on today's program or to listen to the show, visit WFPL.org. I'm Rick Hallett. Have a good weekend.